I know you love Netflix's Making a Murderer and The Staircase. Who doesn't? Listeners in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth will have a chance to win double tickets to see Inside Making a Murderer and The Staircase, a conversation with lawyers Laura Nyrider, Stephen Drizin and David Rudolph. All you have to do is head to our Facebook page or Instagram, follow the link and tell us your favourite Australian true crime episode and why in 50 words or less. Leave your details, sign up to our mailing list if you haven't done that already, and don't forget to tell us whether you're from Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide or Perth. And the best two entries from the five capital cities will win. Patrons will also have an extra chance to win tickets. Okay, so just head to Patreon to find out more about that. Entries close on Monday, the 11th of March. Thank you to our lovely new patrons. So many new patrons. Andrea Cole, Kate, Mickey Gubis. That's a cool name. I hope I'm saying that right. Angela Layton, Diana Cornelli. We need bigger fonts, guys. My eyes aren't what they used to be. Jody Zara, Sonia Wisby, Alice Arnold, Alyssa Cross, Beck and Opal Woods. Opal, what a beautiful name. Monica Burkett, Rebecca Curtin, Rodney Goff, C. Penny, Michaela Scott, Anne-Marie Lockery. Yes, Lockery. Anne-Marie Lockery. That's beautiful. Brianna Tomasinski and Chantel Allen. Beautiful. Thank you so much. Welcome aboard, my friends.
Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
A couple of months ago, I spoke to Ken Kratz, who's pretty much the undisputed villain of Making a Murderer, the documentary series. Of course, the fact that I spoke to Ken made lots of people mad for lots of different reasons, but they all agreed in their demand that I speak to the lawyers defending the men he successfully prosecuted for the 2005 murder of Teresa Halbach. Those men are Stephen Avery and his nephew, Brendan Dassey. Well, of course we've been trying to get interviews with those lawyers, but they're very, very busy. By the time I spoke to Ken last, the second season of Making a Murderer was airing, and it revealed that both convicted men are now represented by women, each with a passion for and a successful history of freeing the wrongfully convicted. What I've come to learn is that freeing the wrongfully convicted isn't an especially lucrative corner of the market, but it is incredibly time-consuming and laborious. The two women representing Avery and Dassey have both been at it a long time. They both have high-profile wins to their credit, but they seem to have very little else in common. They go about their business in very different ways, and they try to keep their clients very separate in the public's minds. They both refused to discuss the other's client. Stephen Avery hadn't had any legal representation at all for 5 years since losing his Supreme Court appeal in 2011 because by that stage he had no money left. In 2012, he saw a TV report about an attorney from Chicago with a great record for getting innocent people out of jail. And even better, she worked pro bono, which means she didn't get paid until she won people's cases and they were able to sue for wrongful incarceration. Stephen and his then-girlfriend started writing letters to that attorney, Kathleen Zellner, but it took 4 years for them to get a response. When they did, she made both them and, no doubt, Netflix very happy because she's as watchable on television as she is successful in court. She's what we Australians would call a massive shit-stirrer.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
During and after the second series of Making a Murderer, which made her a superstar, Zellner started dropping massive bombshells about the case on Twitter, which were, of course, reported around the world. She said she had new evidence that would clear Avery. She said he'd be out of prison within months. And she started accusing other people of killing Teresa Halbach by name. Whoever deleted those phone messages is the real killer, she tweeted one day. Of course, tens of millions of viewers saw Teresa's ex-boyfriend, Ryan Hilligas, testify in Series 1 that he'd deleted Teresa's voicemails. Zellner went on to file a motion in July of 2018 suggesting that Brendan Dassey's older brother Bobby and their stepfather Scott Tidek are viable suspects in the case. And no, neither Bobby nor Scott knows Ryan, in case you're wondering, so this is an entirely new and unrelated accusation. As time marches on without any of Kathleen's big bombshells actually paying off, without investigators agreeing with any of her theories about other suspects, or the courts agreeing to retrials or retesting of evidence, the big media outlets are less interested in covering Kathleen's every move or in live crosses to her office. But she still tweets up a storm every day. Brendan Dassey, meanwhile, has been under the rather less stormy care of the Centre on Wrongful Convictions since shortly after his conviction in 2007. The centre's founder, Steve Drizin, approached Brendan's attorney with an offer of help, and the offer was gladly accepted. At the time, Drizin and Laura Nyrider, who was one of his students back then, were working hard on a case that was the subject of another documentary series. The first film in that series was called Paradise Lost, and it told the story of three teenagers from a town called West Memphis who were jailed for the murder of three small boys. No physical evidence linking them to the crime was produced at trial, nor were there any witnesses, but there was a confession. One of the accused, 17-year-old Jesse Miskelly, who is intellectually impaired and who later recanted his confession, provided the only significant evidence for the prosecution. Not only were the West Memphis Three, as they became known, found guilty of the murder of the three children, but one of them, Damien Eccles, was sentenced to death for the crime. He was 19 years old. Drizin and Nyrider would go on to successfully lobby for the release of Eccles and his co-accused in 2011. And Damien Eccles has written several books, including the New York Times bestseller, Life After Death. A big part of the West Memphis 3 victory was the huge campaign they had behind them. Eddie Vedder and Johnny Depp were throwing benefit gigs for these guys. Peter Jackson, who directed Lord of the Rings, hired private investigators to re-investigate the crime and prove they didn't do it. Well, for whatever reason, Avery and Dassey don't have any rock stars in their corner. But Brendan has Steve Drizin and Laura Nyrider. A quick Google will demonstrate an intense international speaking schedule. A tireless world tour of advocacy finally makes it to Australia in the next couple of weeks, which means I finally got to speak to Laura, who somehow manages to fit in a personal life too. I started by asking her if, after years of working with children who'd been wrongfully convicted, having children of her own changed her approach to work in any way.
You know, I wouldn't say that it's changed things for me in the way that I approach these cases and this work. You know, for about 11 and a half years, I've represented children and teenagers who have been accused of crimes that they didn't commit. And, you know, it's been a real passion of mine ever since my introduction to the work, which was, of course, Brendan's case. That's the first taste I had of the U.S. criminal justice system. But, of course, you know, I've got two sons myself. You know, they're still small. But, you know, I look at them and I think about Brendan and I think about our other clients who are behind bars and, you know, who have sort of lost their free lives in these cases. And of course, it's hard for any parent, right, to think about things like this happening to their own kids.
I was talking to my daughter last night about the fact that you and I would be talking, and I was explaining to her who you were and showing her some video of you on YouTube. And of course, she was, you know, really impressed and excited to see a woman like you working. But then she said to me, she's 9 years old, and she said, oh, could that happen to me, you know, and as in what's happened to Brendan? And I said, I don't think so. I mean, for a lot of reasons, but also I feel like there's a kind of young person who finds themselves in this situation. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like there's a set of circumstances that are probably fairly common to this situation. When I look at people like Brendan Dassey and, say, Damien Eccles, do you find common traits among the people that you work with?
Yeah, so it's a great question, right? You're right. At the Center on Wrongful Convictions, my colleagues and I have worked on a lot of different cases around the country involving children and teenagers who've been wrongly convicted. And in particular, right, folks who have falsely confessed. And it is true that, you know, being young, having intellectual disability, which is true of Brendan, not of Damien, those can be risk factors for false confession. Absolutely. You know, when you look at all the false confessions that have happened out there that lawyers and researchers have uncovered, yes, you know, kids and the mentally impaired are overrepresented in those cases. But what's interesting is that sort of the annals of false confession cases also include honor roll students, you know, street smart kids, white collar workers, perfectly sort of normal functioning people. That's the fascinating thing about psychological interrogation. It works on everyone. Every one of us has a breaking point. And these techniques that are used in the interrogation room are designed to find that breaking point for each and every single one of us. For somebody like Brendan, it happens quicker and it happens easier. But those techniques work on everyone.
In the end, is it really about the desperation for the interview to end?
Well, that's a big driving force. Absolutely, the desperation for the interview to end. So the way that interrogation works generally, right, is it's a two-step process. It's a very carefully sequenced set of pressures that are all deployed in order, all geared at one thing and one thing only, which is producing a statement, right? So the way this works is really by turning the world upside down for a suspect, right? The officers will say things like, look, you're facing murder charges, but we'll be able to help you if you talk to us, right? Mm. You're caught. We found your fingerprints on the gun. We found your DNA at the scene. Even if that's a lie, officers are allowed to lie about the evidence, right? So we've caught you. I've got three witnesses in the room next door who have identified you, but don't worry, I can help you if you only say these things. And this goes on and on for hours and hours and hours until the world turns on its head. And to the person inside the interrogation room, it's like charges if I don't talk, but maybe help if I do. That's how these techniques work. That's how they generate confessions. They're really, really powerful techniques that are very good at getting true confessions, but they're so powerful that they can also get false confessions.
And we hear over and over again people say, but I knew I was innocent, so I thought, well, they can't convict me. They can't find me guilty because I'm not. So I thought, well, it doesn't really matter what I say.
Well, that's a part of that. It happens in false confession cases too. Mm. Not every case, but when you have somebody who's maybe a young, impaired, naive in the interrogation room, it's like, well, these people are telling me that they'll help me if I say these things. Mm. I know they're not true. I know this isn't me, but okay, I don't know that officers are allowed to lie. I don't know that officers are allowed to deceive. I can't tell that I'm being manipulated. So okay, I guess I'll say these things because they're telling me it's good, right? So that's exactly the way that this works.
Damien Eccles actually in particular spoke about that, didn't he? That when he was young, he was sort of, he had a rebellious streak. And so there were moments where he said things that he knew were just kind of inflammatory, and he was having a little bit of fun with it because he thought, well, it's crazy what I'm saying, but I'm not guilty of any of these crimes, so they can't hold it against me. It's not like I'm going to be found guilty and sent to death for these terrible crimes. I didn't do them.
So in Damien's case, Damien actually did not confess to this crime.
No.
To police, right? This is the West Memphis 3 case from Arkansas from 1993. And this is, you know, three little eight-year-old boys who go missing. It's this horrific crime in West Memphis, Arkansas. The three little boys are found sort of partially submerged in a drainage ditch. They've been brutally, brutally attacked. Mm. And these three teenagers, Damien Eccles, Jesse Miskelly, and Jason Baldwin, were charged with these boys' murder under the theory that because they listened to Metallica and wore black t-shirts and dyed their hair black, you know, they must have been sort of satanic worshippers capable of a brutal killing like this. And Damien actually never confessed to this crime. The evidence used against him was different. Jesse Miskelly, the 17-year-old, was the one who confessed in that case. And there are really interesting parallels between Jesse's confession and Brendan's confession, right? Jesse was 17, Brendan was 16. Both of them have intellectual disability, right? Both of them have significantly low IQs, they have learning disabilities, and they have disabilities focused around speech, language, the way you take in information when somebody's talking to you, which are exactly the skills that we use, of course, during an interrogation. So Jesse ends up giving a confession after being questioned repeatedly by police without apparent presence that tracks the police's theory of that crime. He regurgitates and repeats this satanic worshiping theory that they fed to him, just like Brendan regurgitated and repeated the theories of Teresa Halbach's disappearance that the police fed to him. There's really striking parallels between the two cases, and those two cases do a very good job of illustrating how folks like Brendan and Jesse are definitely more vulnerable in the interrogation room.
Yeah, and both of them come from families that are completely ill-equipped to cope with this situation. As it's unraveling, we can see that they're just so many steps behind, aren't they?
Well, you know, what's interesting about Brendan's case is that his mother, you know, did what we see a lot in cases across the board, right? A lot of parents, too, think that it's okay to let police speak to your child, think that, you know, my child did nothing, so of course it's not going to be a problem to allow the officer to speak to my child. We see this happen in all kinds of cases, which is exactly what Barb did, right? It's not the wise choice, but it is a common choice that's made. And so, you know, when you're speaking to your 9-year-old and she's asking you, could this happen to me? You know, that one thing that we always suggest that parents say is, you know, you just say, I'm sorry, officer. If a police officer comes up to you, right? It's just say, I'm sorry, officer. My mom has said to wait, that I shouldn't speak to any stranger without her. So I'd like my mom, please.
It's so difficult though, isn't it? Because then when we see in other cases, people hire legal assistance early, that makes them look guilty as well. I mean, you know, you're in the space where all of this is televised. And so I know I got a message last night from the publicist who's put you and I together, saying that you don't speak specifically to things that Ken Kratz has said. And the only reason I'm bringing that up is because I know that when this interview airs, I'll take a lot of heat otherwise from people saying, why didn't you let Laura talk about the things that Ken said to you? You know, like, because there's so much interest around this case because of the documentary series, and there's so many people who believe themselves to be experts. And so how is the pressure of this huge international community that now feels it's an expert on all of the kinds of intricacies of this law? I mean, at least you're the sort of hero of the piece. That's a lot of pressure, right?
Well, I don't know if I'm the hero. There are many heroes of this story, and many villains too.
Yeah.
You know, I've got to say, when we took Brendan's case 11 and a half years ago, we had absolutely no idea that anybody wanted to make any kind of a film about this, right? It wasn't until 2010 we showed up in Manitowoc for the post-conviction hearing in court. We're there, you know, putting witnesses on the stand, doing what we do as lawyers, and we noticed that there are these two women off to the side with a camcorder who are just quietly filming everything we do. And so after a day or so, you know, we walked over to them. And of course, it was Laura Ricciardi and Moira Demos, the two directors of Making a Murderer. And we said to them, you know, what are you doing? And they said that they wanted to make a movie about this case. And we, you know, we figured it was going to go nowhere, right? I mean, here's these these two women. Moira was still a graduate student, you know, more power to them. But of course, we thought this was going to go absolutely nowhere. We filmed the hearing, and, you know, 2011 goes by. We don't hear from them. 2012, 2013, 2014, and then 2015, they called us. Of course, Netflix got invented somewhere in there.
Yes,
right?
Of course, it didn't even exist. Yeah.
Right, exactly. They call us and tell us that they're making this 10-hour-long show about the case. And of course, our first reaction was, geez, 10 hours is a long time, right? And this show comes out. You know, we're still thinking this is probably not going to be very big, you know. And the show comes out in December of 2015, season one. And it just takes off like wildfire. You know, 20 million people in the U.S. in the first 2 weeks alone, I've been told, just saw season one of Making a Murderer. Mm. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. I'm sort of staring at the screen going, God, why didn't I brush my hair for that interview? You know? Like, my God, what's happening? We're getting deluged with emails and letters and social media messages. And so that's, I guess, a long way of saying that what we've seen after season one, which was totally unexpected for us, has been some of the most inspiring moments of compassion and support and outreach from strangers all around the globe who watched this show, not because they were already interested in the criminal justice system and injustice, but they watched the show and became interested in it and became passionate about Brendan's case and the work. You know, one of the best things that's happened in the wake of season one is that they've sent Brendan letters. People send him letters from all over the world. He still gets about 30 or 40 letters every day from people all over the globe who are just sending him, you know, their good wishes. Keep your head up, hang in there, keep on fighting, we're behind you, you know, that kind of thing. And it gives him incredible hope, because now Brendan, who's 29 years old now, he has friends all over the world. And that sustains him. And it also sustains us to see him happy, hopeful, positive, knowing that the truth is going to come out. That keeps us fighting. So it's a wonderful thing.
So where are we at right now with his case? Again, people get so angry with me who are really invested in this case because I'm not. You know, like, I follow the case, but I feel like you had a major victory, right? And there was a moment when it felt like he was about to be released from jail so that his case could be retried, and then it didn't happen. Where are we at?
Yeah, you're right.
Well, yeah, but I'm also right that it didn't happen. And Laura will explain how it didn't happen after the break. Coming up on this special Brendan Dassey update episode of Australian True Crime with Laura Nyrider, we'll hear how we can support her work with Brendan and her other clients, and we'll also hear some of the moments from that confession tape that she finds particularly troublesome. But first, where is Brendan at right now with his appeal process? Because there was a lot of reporting of a breakthrough last year. You had a major victory, right? And there was a moment when it felt like he was about to be released from jail so that his case could be retried, and then it didn't happen.
Yeah, you're right. We won the federal district court's petition. We got a new trial ordered for him. It was affirmed on appeal. We came within about 12 hours of walking Brendan Dassey out of prison.
Oh my God.
Before the Seventh Circuit put a stop to it by a single vote. We lost 4-3 before the en banc Seventh Circuit. So yes, I mean, it's, you know, it was a high point when we thought we were going to get him out. And of course it was a low point when that was, you know, didn't come to fruition. But the good news is that there is still plenty, plenty of fight left to be fought for Brendan Dassey. This is not over by a long shot. You know, we at our center, my colleagues and I, we've been involved in over 50 exonerations. So we know that, you know, this past appeal for Brendan was just round one. And sometimes you have to go round two, round three, round four. Keep trying, keep trying, keep pulling bricks down from the wall until the wall crumbles. And that's what we're prepared to do for Brendan Dassey. The declaration was that his confession was coerced, and so it was thrown out of court. And the judge also found that he had significant doubts as to the reliability of the confession. Basically, this confession was forced out of him, tricked out of him, and I don't believe it. So let's throw it out of evidence. And the judge gave the state a choice. You know, we're getting rid of this confession, so you, state of Wisconsin, have a choice. You can either retry Brendan Dassey, but without the confession, there's no evidence against him, or you can release him. That was the order.
The Seventh Circuit has authority over that judge?
Yeah, so the Seventh Circuit is the court of appeals that sits over that court. And the way this basically worked is we won that victory in the district court, which is like the trial courts, right? Mm. We won that victory. The state then announced that it was going to appeal that victory. So we decided, okay, you have the right to appeal, but we want Brendan out. We want him home. It was around the holidays. It was November, right before Christmas time. We want him home for the holidays while you fight this appeal. And we asked that same judge who had granted Brendan release, who had thrown out the confession, we asked him to release Brendan. And he did. He issued an order that Brendan needed to be released during the appeal. And so, you know, we put these plans in place. We had a whole arrangement for where he would live, how he would stay safe, secure, you know, have some space, have some peace, have some ability to recover. We had it in place. And again, came within about 12 hours of getting him out before the Court of Appeals said, no, we're going to block that order. We want him to stay in prison while we hear the appeal. So we went forward with the appeal. We won the first round of the appeal. Usually these appeals are done before three judges. That's what happened in our case. We won 2-1. Two of those three judges agreed with the lower court. Yes, get rid of this confession, right? Mm. And then the state of Wisconsin asked the court to pull this very rare legal move that happens in only one out of every 680 cases, which is to throw out the appeal before the three judges and redo the appeal before the full court, which in our case was seven judges. And the court agreed to do that, and we ended up losing that round 4-3. So, you know, the tough part of this case is that in 679 other cases, Brendan Dassey would be free today. Yeah. He'd be home. So, of course, you know, to answer your original question, of course it's frustrating. Of course it's hard to watch this happen, and it's hard to do everything you can do and not to be able to prevent it. But on the other hand, like I say, we know this is just round one, right? We knew, because of our experience in so many other cases, so many other exonerations, that it is not over. The criminal justice system is so fixated on keeping people in prison that you can't take that deep breath until you watch somebody actually physically walk out. You're not free until you crush that threshold, and we know that. So, you know, round one, we came really close, which gives us hope for round two.
Is it image-driven, this fixation with keeping people in prison, particularly high-profile cases like Brendan's? I can't imagine any other reason why it would be a good idea to keep a man like Brendan in prison while you work through this process. He doesn't represent a threat to the community. I think it would be difficult to argue that he does.
No, the judge actually found that he did not pose a threat to the community. So in all of these court papers, of course, when a judge decides whether or not to release somebody, he or she looks at, you know, the person's criminal history before the case and what that person has been like in prison. Mm. Have they been violent in prison, right? Have they been a behavior problem in prison? Brendan Dassey, his record is spotless, absolutely spotless, before this case and after this case. He sort of epitomizes a peaceful, gentle person, and his records show it. So, yeah, the judge in this case determined that he was absolutely no threat to society. That was the basis of the order granting his release.
So do you think it's the sort of the fame, the attention that surrounds this case that has in the end kept him in prison?
I don't think that's it. You know, I can't get inside the judge's head, but I don't think that's it. One of the interesting things about our laws here in the U.S. is that we do have the right under the Constitution not to be forced to confess, but we don't have a right not to be convicted based on a false confession. So if I go into court, or some lawyer goes into court on behalf of a client and says, this confession is provably false, right? The evidence disproves it. Get rid of it. It's garbage. We can see right through it. You lose because we don't have a right not to be incarcerated based on a false confession, believe it or not, which is unbelievable. We only have rights to be not forced to confess. So that's why when you hear the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals arguments, all of it is about whether or not Brendan was coerced into confessing, because the law, as a technical matter, turns a blind eye to the problem of false confession. So in this case, what you have is a confession that it doesn't take a lawyer to see is false, right? Millions and millions of people around the globe know. They saw it on TV. They saw the videotape, right? This is a child who doesn't know what he's talking about when he's trying to describe this murder. But that fact is pushed to the side in court proceedings. We're supposed to only be talking about force, coercion. And of course, there are strong arguments to be made for coercion in Brendan's case, too. And those are the arguments that very nearly carry the day for Brendan. But it's this hole in the law, the way the law just doesn't match common sense, that I think was the ultimate issue that kept Brendan Dassey from winning this first round of appeals.
It is a really incredible example, the film, of his confession. He does appear to be a child who doesn't know what he's talking about until bit by bit it is explained to him, and then he repeats it back, doesn't he?
That's exactly right. I mean, this is one of the most striking moments of this interrogation, is a moment when Brendan, you know, a suspect in a murder case, is being asked how Teresa Halbach was killed. You know, literally, how did you kill her? And this is, I guess, sort of the climactic moment of the interrogation. And poor Brendan, a 16-year-old with no history of involvement in violence whatsoever, he starts guessing, rattling off every means of killing somebody he can think of. The police know because of their investigation, or they think they know because of their investigation, that she had been shot in the head. That's what they want him to say. But instead, he guesses, you know, choking. And they say, no, Brendan, no, not choking. You know, what else did you do to her? He says, well, stabbing. And he asks it like he's asking a question. No, Brendan, what else did you do with her? Something with the head, Brendan. They start dropping him hints, you know, something with the head. And he says, you know, punched her. No, Brendan, what else? Something with the head, something with the head. At one point, he's like so completely confused that he says, we cut off her hair.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And right, and he keeps guessing and guessing, and finally says, that's all I can remember. And that's when the officers get frustrated. You can hear them, you know, on the tape getting frustrated. And they say, Brendan, I'm just going to come out and ask you who shot her in the head. And that's when he says, oh, well, that was Uncle Steven.
What else did he do? We know something else was done. Tell us. Oh, what else did you do? Come on. Something with the head. Brendan?
Hey.
What else did you guys do? Come on.
What he made you do, Brendan. We know he made you do something else.
What was it? What was it?
We have the evidence, Brendan. We just need you to be honest with us.
Did I cut off her hair?
Okay, what else?
What else was done to her head?
Dirty posture.
What else? What else?
He made you do something to her, didn't he? So he would feel better about not being the only person, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What did he make you do to her?
What did he make you do, Brendan? It's okay. What did he make you do?
Cut her.
Cut her where?
On her throat.
What else happens to her? In her head.
Extremely, extremely important you tell us this for us to believe you.
Come on, Brendan. What else?
We know, we just need you to tell us.
That's all I can remember.
All right, I'm just going to come out and ask you, who shot her in the head?
Who did?
Why didn't you tell us that?
Because I couldn't think of it.
Right, and then comes one of the most heartbreaking moments of the entire interrogation. They say to him, Brendan, why didn't you just tell us that? And he says, because I couldn't think of it. Right?
Yeah.
This is a child who's guessing.
I mean, look, the other thing is, of course, you know, what happened to Teresa Halbach? And we keep coming around to that, and that's the unfortunate part of this entire story. There are now 20 hours of documentary devoted to these two men and miscarriages of justice and conspiracy theories and the terrible things that have befallen them. And then in the end, it's like, yeah, but what about her? There's a woman lost in all of this, and there's a family. I know that her family didn't participate in the documentaries, don't want anything to do with it. Have they ever reached out in any way to Brendan or about Brendan? Are they involved in any way?
You're right. That's one of the underlying tragedies of wrongful conviction cases, is you do have a family that has borne tremendous the kind of pain that no person on this planet should be put through. There's no doubt about that. Absolutely. You're right. And so I've actually had wrongful conviction cases in which the victim's family actually approaches us and asks us to take the case.
I bet.
Because they know the wrong person has been convicted.
Then they must feel like, well, we need to fix that so that we can then get an investigation going, you know, in the right direction.
And one of the best advocates around all of these questions having to do with the need to seek justice for victims and victims' families is a woman on our board of directors, a woman named Jean Bishop, who actually created a video supporting Brendan Dassey that you can find on my Twitter feed. She's a family member of several murder victims. Several members of her family were murdered, and she's been there, right? She's walked this horrible walk and knows how crucial it is for the system to get it right. We're very grateful for her support for Brendan and the support of other folks who just want to see justice done in this case.
And of course, that's how the Stephen Avery story started as well. Oh gosh, it's a nightmare. And we must remember that Brendan is not your only case, is not your only client. How many clients are you working for at the moment?
I'd say about 5 to 10 cases.
Wow.
At any given time. We at our center receive about 3,500 letters every year from inmates around the country who are asking us to represent them in their wrongful conviction cases. And there are only 4 of us here at the center. So as you can imagine, that we choose our cases very, very carefully. We screen them, investigate them as best we can before we choose to become involved with them. But, you know, we also have a great track record of success with our cases, which we stick with, you know, sometimes for 10 years, sometimes for 15 years, as long as it takes to get it right in the case. In fact, just this past January, our center was able to exonerate 3 people and walk a 4th out of prison from New York, Arkansas, and Illinois. So it's work that takes a long time, that comes with its frustrations, that certainly comes with its challenges. But oh, that moment of freedom when you see somebody walking out those prison doors, somebody you've gotten to know, somebody you care about, somebody you believe in, you know, that's the moment that makes it all worthwhile.
That is amazing. That is amazing. What a wonderful way to spend your life. And to use your incredible brain, Laura, what a way.
Well, I don't know about that, but I had a great time talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I had a great time watching videos of you last night with my daughter. It was really great. And she was so inspired. It was really cool.
Well,
thank you.
Tell her she needs to be a lawyer.
Yeah, maybe. She's at that stage in her life where she's thinking about things. And yeah, I wasn't expecting her to wander in and be interested in what I was doing. And she really, really was. She sat and watched for ages. And now how can we support you? Because I know a lot of our listeners will be thinking, I want to help Laura. I want to do something. Can we donate to the Center on Wrongful Convictions? How can we help you?
Yeah, if folks want to, you know, find out how they can support the work, they can visit www.centeronwrongfulconvictions.org. They can find a lot of information about the case there. They can find other resources they can use to educate themselves, books they can read, films they can watch, other cases to learn about and get involved in, and, you know, ways to receive updates about the case as it happens. So we look forward to seeing people on our website, on our Twitter feeds, and of course, we look forward to seeing people when we come to Australia and New Zealand next month.
Of course, yes, we'll have lots of listeners there in the audience cheering you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great day. Bye. Thank you for downloading this special episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back with another episode next week.